really dumb.
Doesn't work. Okay, so maybe I should just hold this.
Well, I don't know.
Why don't we ever use one of these over here?
Well, you know what? I'm just going to put it in here, and we'll get enough volume just from it being nearby.
It flops around.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Oh, I see. It's really not enough.
Okay.
Woo!
Let's try this.
There you
go. I mean, it's a little small for that, but it's going to sit there really nicely.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have known of you guys for a long time because at one point our church lost our property and we had to very quickly find other church homes. And I was the women's ministry coordinator at the time. And I started visiting churches and I felt like I had a big H on my forehead. Homeless. We're homeless. And we were too large of a ministry to really fit anywhere. We had a couple hundred women with 50 children in our child care, and we just literally couldn't find a church big enough. There were a few in the area. And I came here, and I'm not kidding, I started crying when I saw your space because I just thought, this would be perfect for us. What if they say no?
The building, it was being renovated, right?
We had to search for a new place to build a new building.
No, our material was being...
you were here. It was totally done. We were here. I was in this room for 5 years. Loved it. You said yes. Cherrydale said yes to us. And you treated me like I was on staff here. I felt like this was my office. The staff were wonderful towards us. And I think somewhere in the middle of that, I don't quite remember how I got connected to you guys. I don't know where that came from or what happened. But so I've just had the honor of being with you several times. And I love what you do. I love that you meet to encourage one another. I love that you have older friends who are walking alongside you through this season of life. I love that you choose a theme every year. For some reason, that's probably my favorite part of Kindred. And so when Christina called, I'm like, what's the theme? Because I just always think, okay, they're asking the Lord, what should they focus on? So what might the Lord give me to encourage you in this theme? And I was super excited when she told me that it was the Psalms of Ascent. And I remembered that I had bought a Beth Moore study on the Psalms of Ascent. I had bought it years ago, but I had never done it. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to immerse myself in the Psalms of Ascent for the next few months. We talked in November, and we kept choosing a date, and it ended up being March. And so it gave me more time to enjoy thinking about the Psalms of Ascent. And here is one of the fascinating things that I learned about. I don't know if you guys have talked about this at all, but the Psalms of Ascent... these 15 psalms have come to be associated with the Israelites once they moved into the land and went to all of their tribal allotments and began their lives. Part of God's law for them was that they were called to come to Jerusalem 3 times a year to celebrate 3 separate feasts. Wherever they were, hello, Kristen Brown. She just popped in. They were called, whatever they were doing, to stop what they were doing. I don't know if they were farming, if they were raising kids, changing diapers, overseeing their livestock. Whatever life was throughout the land of Israel, they were to stop and pack up the kids and travel to Jerusalem. Now, can you just imagine the disruption in their life that would be? You all know how much effort it took you to pack up your kids and get in the car this morning. They didn't have cars to get into. They weren't going to be in Jerusalem by lunchtime. Most of them walked for hours, if not days. So 3 times a year, God said, I want you to come to Jerusalem and celebrate the feasts, these 3 feasts. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. And so it was a time that God was calling them to literally make him central in their lives. Whatever you're doing, whatever life has for you, I want you to stop and come and worship me. And it would have probably felt like a massive interruption.
And it would have felt like, oh, okay, life is hard enough as it is, and now I need to stop everything. Everything I'm doing just to survive, now I need to stop everything and set out on a journey. And these 15 Psalms have become associated with that journey. And one of the things that we find out is that life was really hard for them. I went through these 15 Psalms and just looked for all of the phrases that described what life was like for them. And I came up with 7. Let me just read them to you. Number 1, save me from lying lips and deceitful tongues. 2, I live among those who hate peace and are for war. A verse we just looked at this morning. We have endured ridicule from the proud and contempt from the arrogant. 4, men attacked us. Their anger flared against us. 5, they have oppressed me since my youth. 6, I love this one because I love the visual. Plowmen have plowed my back and made their furrows long. Does that sound like oppression? Someone is just on your back and they're making deep furrows. 7, I am among wicked men who hate Zion. When they came into the land, they didn't drive out all of the inhabitants who were living there. So they lived amongst enemies from day one. There were people who were opposed to them. There were people who ridiculed them. There were people who didn't believe in their God and had their own gods. They were constantly living in a place, in a moment of strife. And in the middle of that, in the middle of hard life, they were asked 3 times a year to pack up the kids, get all the lunches, get the food, start walking to Jerusalem. So I think we can safely call their journeys to Jerusalem a distressful journey. Life was distressful where they came from, and life was probably stressful and distressful on this journey. And actually, we get a great picture of the very first verse of the very first psalm in the Psalms of Ascent. And it's Psalm 120, and it says, I call on the Lord in my distress. That kind of says it all. It sums up what life was like for them. I call on the Lord in my distress. Does that sound familiar to you? So much of life, we've already, Jess has shared so well, what is already so hard about the life we live in, what's happening globally, but also what's happening in your own life. Life outside the garden means that more often than not, life is going to be hard and challenging more than it won't be. A lost job, a broken relationship, a frightening report from the doctor, a family member who's walked away from the Lord, the death of a dear friend or a family member, a failed business. I think we probably, out of all those things I just mentioned, there's probably someone in the room who is dealing with that or has dealt with that. And if it's not that, it just might be the transition of life and the vulnerabilities of things changing in your life. The journey is distressing. Just like they were on a journey, we are on a journey. We're trying to get from point A to point B, and we're doing it in the midst of sometimes really challenging circumstances. And so I thought to myself, can we learn something from our ancient friends who wrote these songs or sung them on the way to Jerusalem? We don't know. But what are there some keys that we can focus on? And I found these 3. Watch, wait, and worship. So this first one, watch. And it's your theme verse, right? I lift up my eyes. Look up. There's something that they knew about, okay, the first thing I need to do when life gets tough is I need to look up. I need to lift my eyes up. Because when I'm doing that, I can watch and see where the Lord's at work. How does the psalmist know that his help comes from the Lord? Because he looked up. This is just not an easy thing for us to do, but when we look up, we're giving ourselves the opportunity to watch where the Lord is at work. If we're looking down at our circumstances, the world becomes really small and we live in a really small story. He's actually calling us to live in a larger story where he is at work in those circumstances. The Israelites would stop whatever they were doing and start walking up to Jerusalem. I don't know if you've noticed that phrase. Whether you're coming from the north or the south or the east or the west, when you are going to Jerusalem, you are going up. It was physically a little bit of a higher elevation, but it was also meant as a term of reverence and respect for the place where God would dwell. So they would go up to Jerusalem. It forced them to look up. And they were on this journey. And you know what they got when they arrived? Jerusalem was where the very presence of God lived in the temple. Remember, this is under Old Covenant times where the physical presence of God dwelled in one place, and it was in the temple. They didn't have the benefit that you and I have under the New Covenant of the presence of God living inside of us because of Jesus' death and resurrection. They had one place to go, and it was the temple. We have the benefit of the New Covenant, and yet, isn't it so hard for us in the midst of what's hard to feel God's presence? It's so hard for us to watch and see where he's at work in the midst of pain. I think I shared this illustration with you guys a few years ago, but it bears repeating because it's one that I come back to all the time. Imagine your life as a glass full of water, and it's not full, it's half full. There's two spaces in this glass, right? There's water and there's air. Think of your life like this. Think of everything beneath the water line as just the world that you live in. You're a wife, you're a mom, you're an employee, you're a student. You go to work, you change diapers, you prepare dinner. You all have a world that is a set of circumstances at any given time, what's going on in that world. That's the lower half of the cup. That's what you can see. It's what your senses can pick up. Ah, okay, this is what's going on around me. But above the waterline is the unseen. It's where God is at work in the lower half. The upper half of the cup is where God is at work in the lower half. And it is so hard for us to look. I mean, it's a little bit of an oxymoron. Look at what you can't see. Yeah. And yet it's a command of Scripture. Do you remember Paul giving this command to the Corinthians? So we fix our eyes not on what is seen. We don't fix our eyes on the lower half of the cup, but on what is above, the unseen. We fix our eyes on Jesus. Looking up causes us to see where God is at work. It forces us to ask the question, what's he doing in the unseen world that I can't see? But we can look up. We can watch for where he's at work. It's the larger story, and it's the only one that matters. The rest of that verse is because what is unseen is eternal. What is seen is temporary. So the Israelites had to look up in the upper half of the cup, and they were reminded of the truths of God when they did this. What did they immediately realize when they looked up? Oh, he's my help. He's the maker of heaven and earth. They were reminded of that immediately when they looked up. Looking up gives us a picture immediately of who God is and what he's like. One of the other things they discovered when they looked up, it's in your psalm, Psalm 121. He declares four times in that psalm that he, God, is watching them. When they look up and watch to see what God's doing, they see that God is watching them. Verse 4 of that psalm, he watches over Israel. Verse 5, the Lord watches over you. Verse 7, he will watch over your life. Verse 8, the Lord will watch over your coming and going. He mentions it four times in three verses. Do you think he was trying to make a point? He's watching you. God watches you. He sees and he knows and he cares what circumstances you are in right now. Right now. Look up. Watch for where he's at work in those circumstances. What else do the Israelites see on the journey? Here's the other key. They're waiting. It takes time to get from wherever they are to Jerusalem. But it's not passive, right? They're moving. They're anticipating what is to come. They're anticipating getting to Jerusalem and being in God's presence. They're moving painstakingly, and it's taking days to get there. But they're clearly anticipating and clearly hoping for what is to come ahead. In Psalm 130, in our 15 Psalms, the writer mentions waiting three times. It's as if he's reminding himself, oh, that's right, this is what I do. I'm a waiter. I wait. Verse 5, I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. And then he says it again in verse 6, my soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen wait for the morning. And then he repeats that line, more than watchmen waits for the morning. If you've ever worked a night shift, if you've ever stayed up all night with one of your babies, ooh, you know what it's like to wait through the hard, later, darkest hours of the night until morning comes. It's not passive. You have to stay focused. You have to have an energy toward it. And you have to have intention when you're waiting for something. When I can't see where God's at work, sometimes I just have to wait. And it takes a strength to wait. Some of you might remember this. I did not meet my husband until I was 43 years old. And so I was single for a really long time. As those years wore on through my late 30s and my early 40s, it got harder and harder because I really wanted to be married. And the older I got, I thought, okay, this might not happen. And I was just devastated because I really wanted to be married. There were some seasons within that where I was in so much pain that I just got sideways in my relationship with the Lord, and I was not experiencing joy. I was not experiencing full life that I knew he offered. And of course, I knew there was something wrong with me in that because it certainly wasn't his fault. But I had lost a sense of joy for the Lord and for life. And it was terrifying because I thought, oh my gosh, I can't get out of this. I'm going to feel this way for the next 30 years and then I'm just going to die. I mean, I was in complete and utter despair. And there were a few things that I had to do to just grasp little teeny items. What I have here is a framed yellow sticky. I was such a mess that I had to write on a yellow sticky Psalm 27, verse 14. And that verse is, wait for the Lord, be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. I just literally had to put it on the printer that was right next to my desk so I would see it about 15 times a day. And I just had to go, oh, that's right, okay, I'm waiting, okay, I just need to wait. That was on my printer for years. Years, even after I met Steve, I didn't want to take it off. It got me through those seasons. And so actually, Steve actually framed it for me later. Be strong is in that verse. It takes strength to wait well. Take heart. It takes all your heart. Other translations say, instead of take heart, take courage. It takes courage to wait. It takes courage to believe that God is good, even in the midst of what feels so awful in my life and whatever doesn't make sense. Because we're staking everything on the fact that when life has fallen apart, he is good. And that actually leads to our third key, and I think you might not be able to see the reference, and I think it is Psalm 126, verse 3. The Lord has done great things for us. To watch for the Lord and to wait for him and to believe and actually see that the Lord is good is a form of worship. All of life becomes worship when we live in that kind of faith and we celebrate the conviction that God is good in the midst of our challenging circumstances. The psalmist who wrote this psalm, Psalm 126, he's saying, the Lord has done these great things, and we are filled with joy. Do you know when he wrote that? When they were in exile. They had been destroyed and carried off to Babylon. They lost everything they had, everything they owned, and lived in exile. They were completely displaced. Talk about life not working. And we are filled with joy. What I love about this psalm, the thought immediately occurs to us, how could you possibly know joy when everything is falling down around you, when you've been forced to go live somewhere else? I love this kind of joy because it exists right along pain. Verses 5 and 6, the writer says, those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. He who goes out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy. So both of them are there. Joy. He's done great things for us, and our lives and our hearts are filled with joy. And at the same time, we came back to our desolate city, and we were just, tears were streaming down our faces. Isn't that just a beautiful picture of a farmer moving into his world? His tears don't paralyze him. They don't stop him. He keeps moving forward. In his pain, he's moving into life. And I know you guys know what that feels like. During this really difficult season for me, when I was in I was crying like every day, and I would be in my car and all of a sudden a wave of grief would come over me and I would just start crying and I'm like, great, I'm on my way to Young Life Club. I'm going to go love kids for the next 3 hours. And I came to realize, I'm telling you, those were the moments of intimacy with the Lord. Knowing joy doesn't diminish your pain. It doesn't reduce it. It doesn't dismiss it. It doesn't take it away. They coexist. In fact, when the tears are coming, don't try to stop them. Sit in your tears. Sit in your pain, because that's the place where the Lord meets you. That is the place where the Lord met me at the worst season of my life. That is still the time that I was the most intimate with him. I would get in the car and go. I'm still going to keep working for the kingdom, even though I'm crying. You guys might have changed a diaper this morning and you were crying. Like, you're still moving into life. Keep moving into life. It's a form of worship because it says, I know God is good even in the midst of this pain. I'm going to keep moving forward. That's where the Lord meets us. On my little sticky note, I also have verse 13, the one that comes before verse 14, wait for the Lord. And verse 13 is this. I am still confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. I was in such a place where I could not feel the goodness of the Lord, but I could see it. I could see it and I could look for it. I could look up and look. Good was all around me, and I had to hang on to the fact that I would see it and acknowledge it, even if I wasn't feeling it. And I feel like the psalmist talks himself into this. Hey, I'm still confident of this. I haven't lost this hope. I am still confident this is true. I will see his goodness. It's almost as if he's willing himself to do it. I know it exists. I know his goodness exists. One thing that's just fascinating about the command that God gives them to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year for these 3 different feasts is he actually has to command them to celebrate. He has to tell them, hey, when you're there, rejoice. I mean, it reminds me of Northern Virginia. We're so uptight. We're overachievers. Everything's so intense. No, actually, have a good time. It's just crazy. He says, celebrate the Feast of Weeks and rejoice before the Lord your God. But it makes sense. Their lives were so hard. He actually had to say, stop, stop, no, and remember. Be joyful. Deuteronomy 16:13. At the Feast of Tabernacles, be joyful at your feast. Your joy will be complete. Sometimes we just need to be told, okay, celebrate what is good. What do I know that's good? What is it that I know about the Lord? And one thing I want you to be reminded of what's true for you all the time, no matter how hard life is, He is always doing you good. Jeremiah 32, he says, I will not stop doing them good. Verses 40 and 41, I will never stop doing good to them. I will rejoice in doing them good. Do you know when he said that to them? When Jerusalem was being besieged by Babylon. And we have a really clear picture this week in our minds what it looks like when a city is besieged. And it is horrific, isn't it? This was the worst possible time in their lives. And God is saying, I will not stop doing good for them. This is hard for us to feel and understand when life feels so bad. And in some ways, it doesn't make sense to us. And I have this thought that if it doesn't make sense to us that God is always doing us good, it's possible that the good he's doing is a good we don't properly value. It's possible that the good he's doing is actually just providing himself. And he actually values that more than we do. The good we hope he will do is to relieve us of our pain or to change our circumstances or make life work or make things better. That's usually at the top of our list of our good. At the top of his list, I'm going to be with you. You can draw near to me. The new covenant reality is that we get to draw near to him. We don't have to hike 3 times a year to Jerusalem. He sees us, he knows us, and he cares. He's watching over us, and he knows exactly what you're going through at any given time, no matter how awful it is. And in those moments, he has said in his word that he's doing you good. So look up and look for what the good is. We can know him intimately in our pain. That is the good that he's doing. We can experience his lavish love for us and actually know the joy of that intimacy. That will cause us to worship. So these are the keys that I believe we've gotten from these psalms, the 3 things that we can think about on a distressing journey. It was a distressing journey for them, and it's a distressing journey for us most of the time. Watch for where he's at work. Be strong and courageous and wait for him and recognize the good he provides when he provides himself, and that will lead to worship, and all of life will become worship. Let me pray for you. Lord, thank you for these women. Thank you that they're here because they're